Okay, we are learning Sefer Melachim. We are in the 9th chapter, and this is the third and final week. We'll be concluding this parak today. We are up to Pasuk Tes Vav, which is on page 104. Just to remind ourselves a little bit of what we were discussing in the beginning of this parak, we found the second time in which God speaks to the king, to Shlomo, and gives him the warning that although the Beit HaMikdash is beautiful and everything, and it's all of its splendor and glory, but in order to retain that, it's necessary to make sure that you, as well as all the nation, all the Jewish people, continue to be steadfast in the midst of observance. And we also mentioned to remember, as we saw on page 102 in Pasuk Tes, verse 9, that God took us out of Egypt. Because the reason why we would lose the Beit HaMikdash is forgetting the notion or forsaking the God that took us out of Egypt. What do you mean the God that took us out of Egypt? That was many, many years ago. The point, as we said, was the importance of always showing appreciation. Hakarat Hatov. Hakarat Hatov really means recognizing the good and acknowledging when someone does something good for you. And Hashem, who took us from being slaves, that we had no future. Our future was just to remain as a slave. God gave us the opportunity to be free people, and for us not to show our appreciation is completely kafui tov, denying any good. And in fact, in the last week's parsha, in Parshas Bereishis, we found that Adam was considered to be a kafui tov. The great sin that he did was not necessarily eating from the tree of knowledge, but it was when being confronted, he blamed someone else. He said, it was this woman that has given it to me that I ate. And on that, Rashi says that he denied the good. That God gave him this wonderful person to be able to share his life with. And for him to not appreciate that, that was part of his mistake. And then the second part.
Rabbi, can I just ask you?
Yeah.
Was that meant to be like a warning to Shlomo, to the Jewish people?
Absolutely. This was definitely a warning. And it was worthwhile in the beginning of the Beit HaMikdash, after it was just began, that this warning should be stated so that people know that even though it seems that everything is great, things only remain great if you appreciate things. If you let things slide, then they don't necessarily stay the same. He definitely was given this warning from Hashem. Did he heed this warning? We're going to see some of the mistakes that he'll be making, which will ultimately lead to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. We won't see it in this parak, but we'll see it in the next chapter, in Parak Yud, in the 10th chapter. That we will end up seeing then. So that was the first thing that was mentioned, this warning. And the second part, which we also saw, which began in Pasuk Yud until Pasuk Yud Dalet, which is where we got up to, page 104, we spoke about how he was, after he built the Beit HaMikdash, and he wanted to show appreciation to a king whose name was Hiram, the king of Tsor, and he ended up giving him cities, and the question is, how could he have given him cities? So perhaps they swapped one city to the next. And Pasuk Gimel said that even though he, the king of Tsor, Hiram, did not appreciate these gifts that King Solomon had given him, he still says, Achi, my brother. Because when things are going well, for the Jewish people, they're called my brother. They want to be able to come close to them. And therefore, he was wondering why he received such gifts. We discussed the significance of that city, those cities called Eretz Kabul, last time. So now let's continue with Pasuk Tes Vav, which we'll now conclude to understand how did Shlomo get all this money? How did he get it? Did he win the Powerball? How did he have so much money? And the answer is just like every single politician promises something and doesn't deliver, referring to taxes. I won't increase taxes. Well, Shlomo never made that promise that he wouldn't raise taxes, because you'll see that, in fact, that's how he got all this money. V'zed davar hamas asher he'ela HaMelech Shlomo Livnos Es Beis Hashem Ves Beiso. This is the tax that was levied upon the people, which allowed the King Shlomo to be able to build this Beis Hashem. So the Beit HaMikdash, if you want to say, where's all my tax dollars? Is it hard at work? Where's all my tax dollars? So you look, at least then, you know that it was built for, it was used for something of some good purpose, some benefit. You know, Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple was built on tax dollars. Ves Beiso, as well as the King's Palace. Ves HaMilo, Milo is not translated in the English, it just says the Milo, which we'll discuss what that is in a second. Ves Chomas Yerushalayim, he also built the walls of Yerushalayim. Ves HaChatzor, Ves Megiddo, Ves Gozer. We'll talk about Gozer in a second, but first let's understand what is this place Milo. So Rashi says the following. Rashi says, Ves HaMilo, Ves Mokum Hoyim Yerushalayim Be'ir David. There was a place which was in the capital city in Yerushalayim, in the city of David, Venikra Milo. They called this city Milo. Why? What was it called Milo for? So Rashi says that Shom Al Shem Shemuka Choma Namocha Omolisocha Afar, that they put a circumference around a wall, a deep wall, and they filled with it dirt. So Molo comes from to male, to fill something up. So it was a landfill. That's how it's understood, this particular city. Not everyone has this interpretation. Some people say it has to do with other possible approaches, that Milo is to fill up, means it was filled up with water, as it says in English on page 105, like a moat, as it says. That's what almost it sounds like in Rashi, that they dug something around the city. But instead of putting dirt in it, they may put water in it as a form of protection. And that's a nice interpretation, because after the word Ves Milo, the Pasuk says, Es Chomas Yerushalayim, they built the walls. So the significance of, why do you have to have a walled city? So the simple reason is for protection, to protect you from any enemies that wish to come and raise havoc and try to destroy your town. And therefore, just as he built the Milo, which would be a moat to protect the city, so too there's a wall in that same vicinity to protect the city. That's one interpretation. The English, it says the reason why there were walls around the walls of Jerusalem, and if you can look in 105, it says David had built up Jerusalem until the Milo, but not further. Now that Solomon had extended the city, it was necessary for him to build a new wall around the city, because the most sacred sacrificial meats, which are called Kodesh HaKadoshim, Kodesh Kadoshim, may be eaten only within the walls of Jerusalem, so says the Ralbag. So he says that the reason why he built walls was not necessarily for safety reasons, but for halachic reasons. That there are certain restrictions of eating beyond the walls of Jerusalem. So therefore, he had to create these walls in order that certain sacrifices were allowed to be eaten within the confines of those walls. And obviously, why is he doing it now? It's talking about, in the same breath, the same sentence, of the Beit HaMikdash being built. So it mentions the Beit HaMikdash, which of course now sacrifices are being offered there, so they had to make sure that there was walls for the proper eating places of these sacrifices. Okay. Now the last thing that was mentioned is Gozer. What was so unique about this place, Gozer? It's interesting, in English, they put this next sentence and a half in parentheses. So it gives us a little historical lesson of what Gozer was. Paro Melech Mitzrayim. We know there was a king, and his name was Paro, and he was the ruler of Egypt. All of Yuchad es Gezer, he went, and he captured and fought against Gezer. And as he was able to succeed in taking over this town, instead of using it himself, Yisrafa Ba'esh, he burnt it fire, destroyed the city. Mesekanani Hayoshi Ba'ir Harag. Paro was violent, and that he killed those inhabitants, those Canaanites who lived in the city of Gozer. So what did he do after he destroyed it? So he couldn't think of anything better to do than the Yitna Shiluchim Labito Esha Shlomo. We know that Shlomo had numerous wives. One of them was the daughter of King Pharaoh. That Shlomo married an Egyptian woman, and we discussed at length, was she converted? She must have been that way. But regardless, her father was the king of King Mitzrayim, and therefore Parma felt, you know what would be a nice wedding gift or a nice engagement gift, instead of, you know, some nice china or whatever it may be, you know what we'll give? We're going to give a destroyed, burnt-up city. Ve'yiven Shlomo es Gozer, ve'es beis Charon tachton. And Shlomo built up Gozer as well as beis Charon tachton, the lower Beit Charon. Now, it's interesting, the contrast, even though none of the commentators say this, but I was thinking about it, is that Shlomo was a man of peace. Shlomo was a man of building. He was about doing positive things. Let's build, let's do good things. Paro was destructive. Paro killed people, and Paro destroyed cities. Shlomo's ultimate goal was not to destroy, but to build, to improve. That was his purpose in life. To be able to make things better for him, not just for himself, but for all the inhabitants, for everyone around him. Therefore, as he was given a destroyed city, which is an unusual thing to give, but Shlomo felt that's an opportunity to build. Where some people negatively look at something and say, you know what, this is the only thing constructive I can do is destroy, another person's perspective is, no, let's build. Let's not destroy, let's build. And that's what Shlomo was. Shlomo was the ultimate optimist, a positive individual who was able to find the good, and therefore he was able to build even upon things that other people felt was worthless, that it should just be burnt with fire and completely destroyed. Obviously, this also has to do with the power that Shlomo had. On two fronts. First of all, Shlomo had a significant amount of money because of these taxes. Maybe that's why he was able to build cities that maybe even Paro could not. Furthermore, it's come to show us how Shlomo did not live as, unfortunately, nowadays, our current state of Israel, we're surrounded by enemies on all fronts, all sides, all countries. The reality is that all the different kings and different countries that were nearby wanted to show allegiance to Shlomo. And therefore, by giving him cities, not only do we see that by the king of Pharaoh, but also Hiram, who was the king of Tsor, also was in that same vicinity. Some say it was Lebanon, it was a nearby country, that they all wanted to be able to connect themselves to Shlomo. And the significance, obviously, is that they realize that he's an important ally to have, because he's so powerful, it's worthwhile to make sure to be on his good side. Pasuk Yud Ches continues, Ves Bolas Ves Tamor, or it's in brackets, Tadmor, Bamidbar Ba'aretz. It continues to talk about all the other cities that he built, including Bolas and Tadmor, in the Midbar in the Aretz. So what does it mean that was in the wilderness in the land? Why would you want to build a city in the middle of nowhere? Right? It's almost like Lahavdil, or maybe not Lahavdil, when Bugsy Siegel, he went to this desert land, and he said, you know what, let's build a city, and let's call it Las Vegas. So why would you build over there? People would think it makes no sense. Obviously, it worked out for him. Not for him, but eventually. So the question is, what is the significance of building something in the desert? Why would he want to do that? So, not in our packets, when the Kehillot Rabbah asked this very question. Why would he build cities which are so far away? What's the significance of it? So it says like this, quoting the name of Rabbi Yirmi and the name of Rabbi Shmuel Bar Rabbi Yitzchak. He says that, Nesher Gadol Hayilol Shlomo. The other question that you can ask is, who can live there? And the answer is, Shlomo built it for himself. But if he built it for himself, but it's so far away, he'll never be able to enjoy it. So it says, and of course this doesn't necessarily mean it literally, but Nesher Gadol Hayilol Shlomo. There was this huge eagle, which almost sounds like nowadays the Concorde that was being flown from to be able to get to Camp David for the president. Used to go there, and it would take a short amount of time to get there, and he would spend a short amount of time. It was a way for him sometimes to be able to clear his head. It was a healthy way for a king who has all the stresses of where he is in his palace, where constantly people are bothering him. So for him to be able to go to another city, for him to be able to be more alone, to be able to think about all the different things that are happening politically, of course, also spiritually, that was what the purpose of this particular city was. So that's the reason why it doesn't just tell us the name of the city that he built, but it says where it was located. Bamidbar, it was in a vast wasteland. It was in the middle of nowhere. In order to be able to give the understanding that he felt it was necessary to have this place of refuge, this place where he can escape and to be able to do whatever he needs to do without being disturbed as he would have in Jerusalem. What?
What was the name of that city?
It says Tadmor, or Tamar. It doesn't say in the English what the modern day city, what that modern day city would be, but it was out, it was not, you know, it was in the outskirts. It was far away, it was part of the wilderness, it was part of the Midbar. It was obviously somewhere in Israel, presumably, as Ba'aretz, right, so refers to, it was in this land, but it was unpopulated. So that could have been one motivation, as the Kilos Rabba says. Another possibility why he did that is instead of everyone living in the metropolis in one urban concentrated area, one densely populated location, it's possible that his motivation was to try to build other cities in the outskirts to be able to spread the wealth, so to speak, to be able to get people to live on other parts of the land for practical reasons, for the economy, but also for safety reasons. By instead of us all being concentrated in one place, by having cities all around, it's a way of showing that we are I'm in control of numerous locations. Probably, yeah, something along those lines, exactly. And so that could be a political reason why he felt it was important to also build these cities, even though they, at the time, were not populated. The Ace Kol Ari Hamiskanos, Asher Hayul Shlomo, is Ari Harechev, is Ari HaParashim. He also was involved in constructing the Ari HaMiskanos, the cities which, as Masudas Sion says, Ha'oitzerais, which are storage houses. He would have cities which were not just little houses of storage, but cities in which he would keep all of his supplies. Ashariel Shlomo, is Ari HaRechev. He also had chariot cities, is Ari HaParashim, and cavalry cities. So he had different places in which everyone knew, like basic training was in such and such a place. Everyone knows there's certain places where you go in which is a military town. So he created all these different cities for his huge army. Continuing this pasuk on page 106, means Cheshek Shlomo Asher Choshak Livnos B'Yerushalayim Uval Banoin V'chol Eretz Mem Shalto. And all the cheshek Shlomo, all the luxuries, all the things that he desired to have, he built in Yerushalayim, as well as in Lavanayim, in the Lebanon, V'chol Eretz Mem Shalto, and all the places that he ruled. So why did he do it? It's because he enjoyed all the luxuries, because he wanted, first of all, the people to enjoy being there. Right? Everyone loves to live in the same town as a kosher pizza shop. Because if there's no kosher pizza shop, then I'm like, oy vey, how can I live here? I want to be able to move out. And therefore, Shlomo felt it was necessary to have all the luxuries available so that no one felt that they were lacking anything and that they felt comfortable and therefore happy to want to stay and to remain loyal to him as their king, as his king. People accepted it, and perhaps the idea is that the reason why they accepted it is because they saw it was not only for them, it was not only for him. He gave back. So sometimes people get frustrated when they get taxed on all fronts, and there's no benefit. Well, what do I get? Who all my tax dollars go to? The people that aren't working, the people that are not motivated. But if you can kind of give some incentive to the hardworking middle class and to show them, you know what, you're giving, but we're going to also help you out in certain ways, then you're like, all right, fine, I get it.
So what was he really doing?
I mean, it doesn't necessarily say exactly the specifics, but it does say that every luxury that he wished to build in Jerusalem, he built there. Which means that, however we understand that, all the comforts that one would have been used to or longed for was something that he made available, presumably not just for himself. It sounds like for everyone, because He built it in Yerushalayim. He built it all over. In the Lebanon, the land, in all of the land of his domain. Everywhere, anywhere he was, of his dominion. No matter where he was, he built these luxuries. It presumably means that it was for the sake of everyone. That's what it sounds like.
So, this was really the best time that the Jewish people experienced, materialistically anyway.
Right, well, materialistically we see the fact that he was able to tax them, and we don't find them complaining about it. We see how much they were able to build. It was really a golden age for the Jewish people. Yeah, and of course spiritually as well. The Beis HaMikdash, which we've been longing, which was never built, which is the ultimate house of God, the Beis Hashem, finally is built. So it seems like everything is working out. We have a powerful
security.
We have the security. We have a powerful army. We have, you know, the Beit HaMikdash. We have God that's giving over prophecies to people, and people apparently are affluent enough to be able to be taxed and not express too many issues regarding it, unless they're just scared of them getting killed, you know, or whatever, being because he was such a powerful king. But it doesn't seem like that. It doesn't sound like people are really too upset about the whole ordeal. Again, presumably they see what's happening. They see what's happening. And in fact, if I recall,
that was good. It was a good life for everybody.
Yeah, they. And in fact, it's the very beginning of your packet on page 100. The previous parak tells us that the people went back to their tents, Samechim v'tovi leiv, ala kol tova asher asa Hashem li Yisrael amo. That they were happy, and their hearts felt good. They felt good about all the goodness which God had given them, regarding the Beit HaMikdash, and li Yisrael, and to the Jewish people. So we see that things were going well materialistically too. Everyone felt comfortable and happy, content, and they were not in a time of war. Which will lead us to the next question, as we'll see in the next couple of sentences. Pasachav, kol am hanoyser minu ha'mori achit v'apriz v'achib v'abusi. All these different cities, all these different people, asher lo b'mnei Yisrael hema, all these leftover people that remained, that were not among the Jewish faith, b'neihem asher noser achreihem b'aretz, regarding their descendants, which were left over in the land of Israel, asher yochu b'nei Yisrael l'acharimam, that the Jewish people most certainly would not eradicate, they would not cause them physical harm. So what did we do with these people that lived in Israel, and we didn't kick them out, we didn't kill them. Instead, v'yalim shlomo amas, oyved ad hayom hazeh. It says that Shlomo made them into indentured laborers until this very day. So he made them as servants. Instead of taxing them with dollars, they taxed them with service. So they did it. He did it on a practical level. Is that if you have people who are not necessarily going to be loyal to you, even though they live in your midst, the best thing you can do is put them in their place. Let them know that I am the king, I'm in charge, and you, by the way, you're my servant. So that they'll never feel that they're equal or that they can easily overthrow you. Also, by keeping them as an eved, you're able to oversee and watch them. But of course, the fact that they were servants, that they were able to be in the close eye of the king, knowing exactly who these people were, making sure that they were doing the right thing, that they would never consider rebelling against the Jewish people. And furthermore, he would actually win them over, because he would be able to help them out, and they would obviously be taken care of. They would not starve. They would have all their needs taken care of. However, so the question is, and this is a question that some of the commentators ask, is when it comes to these nations, what are we to do with these nations who reside in the land of Israel? So we think that Jewish people must be bloodshed and violence, and, you know, as I mentioned over Sukkot, and that was a Time magazine, it said the front page article, it said right on the front page with the Star of David, why Israel is not interested in peace, which of course is preposterous. So much so that even when we had enemies that lived within, if we look on page 107 in the left column, it second paragraph, it says, according to the Ramban. So Nachmanides says as follows, and I don't want to see the other commentaries, at least this. Even the Canaanite nations were given the option of making peace with Israel. Even though we were more powerful than they were, we could easily have wiped them off the face of this earth without blinking an eye. Nonetheless, we gave them the opportunity to live in peace. That was up front. Provided that they would renounce idol worship and accept the seven Noahide laws. Obviously, we don't want people walking around worshiping idols, which is a bad influence on us. We don't want our enemies also to be a negative influence, which could potentially cause us to assimilate. Although these nations had refused to do so in Joshua's time, and therefore it was sinful for the Jews to let them remain in the land at that time, by now they had accepted the Noahide laws, so that Solomon, despite his great military power, was not obligated to attack them and drive them out. So that's really, as the Ramban points out, a phenomenal halakhic concept of what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to give people the option. War is always the last resort. We never want war. So much do we want peace that even if our enemies are living with among us and we have all the power, we're in the military control of the entire country, we will still give them the ultimatum. We'll say, if you want, you can continue worshiping idols, but you're going to need to leave. We can't be in the same country as you if you're going to worship idols and be sinful, because it's a bad influence. And it's not something which we're allowed. If you're willing to adhere to the laws, basic laws, then stay. And if you don't stay, and you still wish to adhere to all your laws, so you're rebelling against us, and then we'll have no choice but, unfortunately, to have to wage war. That's always the last choice. And therefore, in this context, since these nations did embrace the seven Noahide laws, which, of course, one of them is not worshiping idols, so therefore, they were not to be wiped out or sent away, but rather that they were made to serve under the king. Pasuk Chapez, B'mnei Yisrael lo nasan Shlomo Oved, but Shlomo, the king, did not make any of the Jewish people into slaves. Perhaps, and the reason is to contrast them. If you would make the Jewish people into slaves and the non-Jewish people as slaves, so you would not really be able to distinguish the two. They would be working together, and that's where assimilation, intermarriage, whatever, all these things could come to play. Heim anshei hamilchama, who all the Jewish people had a different purpose. They had a different job. They were anshei milchama. They were men of people of war. They all had different positions in the military. Some of them were commanders, some were officers, and some of them were in commanders of chariots, as well as some were riders. Now the question is, Shlomo means shalom. Shlomo means peace. The Beit HaMikdash can only be built when there's peace. So what on earth is going on? Why was it necessary to have an army? So the Radak says on Pasuk Chaf Beis, Anshei Milchama, very top on page 106, that Afal Pi Shlo Hayelo Milchamos, even though there was no wars, Ki Shalom Hayelo, there was peace. Nonetheless, we call of Arav Ma'at Milchama Hayselo. There's sometimes little fights that occur. Ki Shalom Milchama Saibev Shem Gavev Ayelot. That sometimes, even if there was no major wars, you still had to have an army when it comes to small military battles. Another more simplistic interpretation, which is not cited among any of our commentaries, is the following. And that is, you would think you don't need an army. Why don't you need an army? Because we're in peace. Why are we at peace? We're at peace because we have an army. Once people see that we have such a powerful army, no one's going to want to fight with us. So the whole purpose of having the soldiers is only as a defensive mechanism to ensure that no one will ever want to do harm to us. So the only reason why there was peace is not because we just said he didn't put any money or any of his efforts into the military. On the opposite, by having a strong military, it's a way to ensure peace. It's an interesting philosophy, and perhaps that's what happened over here. Now let's conclude this parak with pasuk. Continue with Chav Gimel. Ela sare hanitzavim asher al hamloch l'shlomo chamishim v'chamish meyos. These were the commanders of his commissioners in charge of the work. 550 commissioners. Haroidim Ba'am ha'isim b'malacha. And their purpose was to be right in to watch over and to supervise those individuals who are doing the work. Achbas paro olsa mi'ir David obesa. Now remember that Shlomo had built the city of Gozer for his wife, the daughter of Paro, Bas Paro. And she went from the city of David, El Beita, to her house, Asher Bana Lo, which he, Shlomo, her husband, built for her. Oz Bana Es Hamilo. And then he built up the Milo. Now, what exactly, is that a good thing, is it a bad thing? So Milo, as we said, was either what's called a landfill, like an open land. Let's say it that way, not as a moat, as another interpretation. So it's brought down in Rashi, about 10 lines before the bottom. It says that this was actually a big mistake that Shlomo made. And in fact, Yerovam ben Nebat, Yerovam, who was, we'll see later on, who was a king over part of the Jewish people, did not want the Jewish people to be oil regal. Did not want them to go up on the pilgrimage festivals of Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. And one of the tactics, there's different reasons why he didn't want them to go up, he ended up having them worship idols instead. It was disastrous. But Rashi says that Yerovam used this concept as a manner to be able to criticize the king. And Rashi says that Avicha anichu porotzel oil regalim. The Ata Beniso Sol Alos Angri Labas Paro. He says, look at how insignificant it is to go up during the pilgrimage festivals. He didn't want people to go. He had his own motivation, which we'll talk about when we get to that. But he didn't want people to go up to Yerushalayim. He wanted them to stay put and to worship idols. And he said, look, your king doesn't even care about it. Because he builds this gorgeous house, this huge city for the daughter of Paro, and for you, the people to live, to go to Jerusalem, all he has is this landfill, this empty land where you'd have to pitch tents. Obviously, he shows no appreciation or significance to the going and ascending to Jerusalem. That was actually, some say, this was a mistake. Pasuk of Hey. Ve'elo Shlomo Shosh Pa'amim Mashana Alois U'Shlomim Alamizbech. It says that the three times, you see this connection, that three times a year he would bring up these elevation offerings, peace offerings onto the altar. Asher Banu Hashem, which he built for God. V'Hakdir Ois Itay Asher Lifnei Hashem. He also brought incense offerings as well. V'Shilim Es Habayis, and he completed the house. Because the house was not complete, he made his house into a home. By making the Beit HaMikdash not just an infrastructure, not just a building, but also a place in which there was the service of God, which is his ultimate purpose. Ba'ani, Pasuk Vav, Ba'ani means, Mesudas Sion is a Sfina, boats, or a boat. Also, Hamel Shlomo Be'etzion Geber. So where should his navy be? Obviously, it needs to be by bodies of water. So one is Etzion Geber, which maybe we're not so familiar where that central location is now, but the next apostle tells us, Asher Es Elos Al Svas Yamsof Be'eretz Edom, which is by the land of Edom, by the seed of reeds. And Elos, perhaps nowadays we're more familiar with Eilat, right? So Eilat, which of course we know is nice scuba diving and snorkeling over there, it's right by the water. So he had his fleet of ships in that location. So he was able to, even in the south, which is far, as you know, it takes, it's a nice car ride. Some people fly from Tel Aviv to Eilat, so it's not that close. But nonetheless, strategically, he wanted to make sure that the water areas were secure. Pasuk of Zion, V'yishlach Hiram b'onies avodav. So Hiram, who again was another ally, sent these ships, as well as people to run these ships, anshe aniyos, people that were experts in sailing, yoidei hayom, those who know the sea, im avdi Shlomo, together with the servants of Shlomo, person to be able to, any person who goes on a ship, goes sailing, has never done it before, and you're in the middle of the ocean with a sail, good luck. You have to know exactly how to do it, you have to be familiar with the direction that winds go in all different places, the tides, and the stars are now maybe with a GPS or a compass, but it's very complex. And therefore, Hiram was able to supply these soldiers or those in the navy to be able to assist Shlomo. Last pasuk, and we'll stop. V'yavo ofira v'yichum yishom zahav arameyaz v'esim kikar v'yaviyu el hamelech Shlomo. And they came to Ophir, and they took gold from there, 420 talents, and brought them to King Solomon. So as we conclude by looking in English on page 108, it says, the Lebanese, because this is how we translated that Hiram was from Sor, which is modern-day Lebanon, were well known for their maritime experience and their knowledge of the currents and tides. Hiram sent some of his sailors to accompany the king on his voyages as a gesture of his devoted friendship. And if we look, we'll just conclude this last paragraph underneath it. Ophir was famed for its gold. So not only was Paro giving, so the king of Egypt was giving things, his wife and the city, his daughter and the city. Also the king of Lebanon gave a whole bunch of gold as well as cities and, in this case, soldiers. Ophir gave a lot of gold. And where was Ophir? So it says apparently located somewhere on the western coast of Africa. But its exact location is not known. Based on ancient stone inscriptions, Rabbi Yisrael Belsky conjures that it may have been Peru. All right, but regardless, all the different countries... Yeah, I'm not sure why it would be Peru. That's what it says here. It would be. You'd want to believe... It makes more sense as the western coast of Africa, let's say northwest of Africa, and up in that area, in which we talked about Egypt, and could also be talking about Morocco and areas in the northwest of, which is makes sense because we're talking about Eilat.
Peru is so far.
I know, and I'm not sure why he comes up with that. I'm just reading. It doesn't sound based on all the set countries near Israel. All of a sudden, you throw up Peru.
Who said Peru?
That's what it says on the bottom of page 108. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Shobelsky says it may have been Peru. I'd like to be able to translate it as the top of that paragraph says, somewhere in the western coast of Africa. And again, if we're talking about Eilat and it sharing this body of water by the coast of the Sea of Reeds, which, of course, Eilat is the southern part of Israel, so that's already near... very close to Egypt, and it's also, therefore, Africa. It's near those other countries. And therefore, we're talking about Lebanon, which is above Israel and now below it, and therefore it all kind of makes sense that everyone is showing their allegiance to Shlomo, to the point that we're now going to see in the next parak, next week, about another person, not a king, but a queen, the Queen of Sheba, that will come and will also show her appreciation to Shlomo, and a lot more than that, as we'll see.